Accession number 9422, reel 5.
Mr. Harold Haywood, Reel 5. I believe you have a story you'd like to tell us about an incident while you were going through France before you got to the lines.
Yes, we were billeted in a village called Vergy, and our particular section was hutted in a barn where one part of it was an old man, a blind old man, who was flailing the corn, and I learnt from the farmer, his son-in-law, that his father-in-law had fought in the Franco-Prussian War, and that I didn't ask, unfortunately, whether he was a French regular troop or whether he was one of the villagers, you know, who generally along the
guerrillas,
French
Frank Tireurs.
Guerrilla, that's right, guerrilla. You know, had done his shooting then against the Germans, but it was rather interesting to have that link with what otherwise had been history for me.
Now, to get back to when you were moving forward to the trenches. As you were going through these communication trenches, you said they were full of mud and it was dark, and as you reached the front line, could you tell us what your first impressions of trench warfare were and how it matched up with your earlier feelings of the Boer War? It would be like the Boer War, you know.
Well, yes. We went in under instruction, as the phrase goes, with the Connaught Rangers, the 1st Connaught Rangers, regular troops. They were rough lads, and we saw them bailing out the trenches best they could with their own Dixies. Well, that seems strange to me, but we didn't like to pull our Dixies out, which we've been issued with at Codford, to do the same thing, something which we're going to use as a vessel to drink from. the Connaught Rangers tea came up in their very large Dixie made up, and it was much to our surprise that their mess cans, which they'd been using for emptying this mud out of the trench, they immediately put in the tea and drank from it. We would have to have things a little different than our mother's afternoon tea table, but it took a little bit of gritting of teeth also to dip our mess cans into the tea that we'd been following the Connaught Rangers bailing out the mud of the trench, but we didn't want to appear different, particularly as we are in with regular troops, and but that rather broke us in harshly to what life could be in the trenches. The other thing was rats. Now, whereas we had to make our way through the mud to along the front line trenches and the communication trenches, the rats, and they were big buck rats, they could run along the top, so they had us at a disadvantage. They knew they only had to get about 10 yards away and they were safe, because the only ammunition we had to deal with them or was our rifles. Well, just the stretch of your arm on your rifle, and they could sit, and they seemed to sit and laugh, turn around and laugh at you at about 20 yards difference. There were two other living species of the rats, and there was the lice, which were not known as lice. The word for the in the line for lice was chats, chats, chats. Oh, I've got chats. And not the first time up, but we found out there was such a thing called Harrison's pomade. And each of us wrote home and said, oh, please, in our first parcel, send some Harrison's pomade. Well, we at night time, when it was 1 hour on and two off, we didn't have real dugouts as the Germans had. We just had little cubbies cut into the back of the trench, and there we lay one on top of another, completely worn out from being out on fire step duty, and glad to get asleep anyhow. And the rats used to get into these cubby holes, containing at the most about four men, legs on top of one another, arms under another chap's body. We didn't bother at all. All we wanted was to get down and have a kip, sleep. So the rats were very sapient creatures. On one or two occasions we got fed up with them running all over us. We decided we would get up, and with our trenching tool handles, you know, with the iron top into which the set, we got up to go for them. And the rats, instead of scooting all round the place, you know, and with everybody lashing out at them, they run up the wall and along the framework, out through a hole in it through which they'd entered, all in one line. And although the last 10 got killed, you know, by digging, at least 6 escaped through this hole instead of them all trying to rush in. I was amazed at the cleverness of it. It used to save them at least a third of their number. They all jumped up to clear away when they saw that we really were getting up, because tired as we were, we just didn't bother to have them running all over us, lying on the floor of the trench.
Were you frightened of rats?
Never. No, not as such, particularly as we got our trenching tools and there were others there. I'd had experience with a rat with at my uncle's farm, when I was a small boy, I was about 7, and I'd been told by my father, never face a rat in a corner. And I didn't take much notice, but on one occasion I went into a small hen roost, and there was a rat in the corner there. And I went for him, and he backed into the corner, and I could see he was going to do what my father said rats do, spring at your throat. So I backed away quickly. And but in France, there, these rats, it was their accommodation as much as it was ours. But what was rather annoying was, and they run along the framework which held this cubby up, they would drop down on us, and to get at our food, which the following day's rations came up about midnight, and each man had his share, and was put in his haversack, which he hung on the wall, didn't have down on the floor where the rats, but we used to put our bayonets through the wall of the trench and hang our haversacks on that. But that didn't stop these buck rats, which would run along, drop onto the haversack, eat the way through the top, and then consume the food in your own haversack. But I thought it was adding insult to injury when two of them fell fighting one another over the last bit of my next day's rations. They'd come through a hole in the bottom of my haversack on my face.
So did they disgust you at all? Did you know whether they were eating dead bodies between the lines, things like that?
No, I don't think it ever occurred to me. This was a very quiet sector, so We didn't have a casualty in our own company for a matter of perhaps 3 weeks.
Besides the rats, you mentioned the lice. How, or the chats, as you call them, how were they a nuisance to you? Could you, you know, in the line?
Well, we don't know where they came from. They just appeared within the turn down of one's shirt. They seemed to get in there all the way up.
By the buttons?
All the way down where your shirt turns in.
I see, yes.
Run down that then there. And of course they bit one. And then we learnt about this Harrison's pomade after we'd been out there perhaps a fortnight. And everybody wrote home to his parents, please send it out. My parents did the same. But of course, where they had bitten, we'd had our hands inside our inner garments and scratching at them. When this Harrison's pomade came out, I, without giving much thought to it or mentioning it to any of my friends in the section, I put this on. Well, anything like it being that similar to that in previous civil life, you rub something in. Mother said, "Oh, rub it in your chest if you're getting a cold." So I rubbed this thing in, and of course it nearly drove me mad. It was to kill the chats and not to ease a sore service. So that on one occasion, where on the first receipt of the first in, I deliberately put my finger in it and put it down all the scratches, which there were blood, and rubbed it in, and I couldn't contain myself. I had to do. This was in the afternoon, in the daytime, where I had time enough to do it, but I've got there, no water to wash it off, and I was nearly driven out of my senses, and I had to run along the up and down the trench, and people said to me, "What's the matter with you?" I start to tell them, but I couldn't stop even to tell them what a stupid thing I had done. I had to run and run, which I did for about 2 hours, till the thing worked off. I did that once, but once only.
Did, when you learnt to use it properly, did you find it effective at controlling the chats?
Not entirely. What I did then learn to do was to, when we got a new clean issue of shirts, I rubbed it down the things before I put it on, not after they got at me. It was there for them to have a go at, not me.
Did you have any other methods of trying to control the lice or chats?
No, that was the only thing. Otherwise, one had to keep that vest or shirt on till you came out of the line and had a bath and issued with a new one. That was a boon when you could have a bath, perhaps when you're back well in reserve to get into hot water or under shower and put clean underclothing on.
What would happen when you didn't have any pomade, Harrison's pomade?
Well, we used our lit cigarette. We smoked a lot of cigarettes out in France, and they were all a comfort, but we used their burning end, their red end, to run up behind the turn down of our undergarments, and that would kill them. And it was a quick way of doing it and an easy way to do it.
During this first bit, how long were you in the line with the 1st Connaught Rangers?
Just for one spell. We were doubling up just for the one turn in. That is to say, 48 hours in, and then 4 days out. But the 48 hours in meant 24 hours in support, immediate support, and 24 hours in the front line, the very front line.
And this, because it was normally a week in or longer, possibly.
Later on, yes, a
but
week or fortnight.
Because of the conditions.
Because of those, the weather conditions and the actual mud.
Before we move on to a detailed discussion of discussions, of conditions. What did the 1st Connaught Rangers teach you? What sort of advice did they give you? Can you remember during this first 48 hours?
Yes, they told us that the Germans were a very methodical race of people, and that at 20 past 12 each night they enfiladed the trench with some whiz-bangs. So we all got down off the fire step and let this fusillade go through, which happened every night that anyone was in the line. That obviously the German artillery had been ordered to fire like that, so we didn't stick our head out. We got down to the bottom of the trench.
What else did they teach you? Because trench warfare was all pretty new to you from what you
said. Yes, indeed it was. About how to do some wiring, you know, when the weather would spoil the wire, and of course if there'd been any the French weren't quite so particular as we were, and they had their holes outside the you climbed out of the trench and used they dug a hole, you know, used that as a lavatory.
Did they teach you about the routine of trench warfare, about sentry setting, that sort of thing?
Yes. For instance, the platoon commander in the Connaught Rangers would teach our platoon commander, and their sergeant would teach our sergeant, and their section corporals would teach our section corporals. And that's how we learnt.
What did you think of these regulars then?
Well, they were a very good sort. They were very willing. We wouldn't have met them perhaps in civil life, but good-hearted, and they would let us have drinks from their Dixies, which we were pleased to have, and we got on very well with them. I expect we were as strange to them as they were to us.
Was their attitude then not... They weren't patronising?
None whatsoever. They didn't patronise at all. They treated us as they might have been treating one of their sister battalions in a brigade like the 1st Devons.
I'd like now to run through the conditions of life during this sector while you were in and out of the front line, because you were there until January, I believe.
That's right.
Just looking at the conditions overall of living in that life. Firstly, I'd like you to describe in as much detail as possible the actual trench system as you remember it.
What we did?
The trench system, the actual trenches, their construction and nature.
There was the front line with its... What do we call those? Where, to stop the shells from killing everybody. Traverse is the word, yes. We had to keep them in good order, and we had to keep the fire step, which was about we could step up from the trench onto the fire step. It wasn't a question of climbing, and then one's head was just about neck high above the actual top of the trench, so that one could look out.
How deep was the front trench approximately? You say the communication were about 6 foot.
Yes.
How deep was the front line?
Well, perhaps I'd better say that a good communication trench was 8 feet deep from the floor to the top of the front line trench would perhaps be about 6 feet.
So the front line was shallower than
than the communication trenches.
What was... You had a fire step and traverses. Did you have duck boards at the bottom of the trench to try and sort out the water and the mud? Or
Yes, there were duck boards, and in order to give some sort of a firm surface, there were even tins of bully beef, which were to serve the same purpose, to get a firm stand that one walked along through the mud onto these hard surfaces. But the mud was so deep at one time that if you put a duck board on it, well, it would be just lying on the top of the mud.
Would the duck board sink into the mud after a time? Or
Yes, and it would be against the floor of the trench.
So you'd have mud on top of the duck board.
That's
then.
It, yes.
What? The front line, could you describe in more detail the sort of dugouts? You say they were cut into the side of the trench. Which side would they be cut into? And could you describe
into the parado, that is to say, if that was the fire step, we were looking at the enemy there, it would be on this,
behind
the parado side.
And what could you describe exactly what they looked like?
Yes, just a little cave cut into the back of the trench.
How deep and how?
Level, not lower. Till later on, we didn't find any going down steps. We just stepped into them.
How far back would you go into the wall of the trench?
Well, I would think it would contain about five men lying on top of one another and no more. Otherwise, your feet would have been sticking out into the trench itself. If you were resting.
So you'd usually lie with your head on the inside, would
you? Yes, yes.
And your feet pointed towards the trench.
That's right, in case you had to jump up quickly, there you were on the way. But of course, during night time, one legs were on top of somebody else's legs, or on the top of his body. He wasn't going to move, he was too confoundedly tired. Shut up, you know, I'm trying to get asleep.
Would you have a place in one of these
dugouts? No allocated place. But we would have, perhaps, there would be, what's the thing again you told me? There was one of these cubby holes about every two traverses, enough to take about five men who would cover, be responsible for that line of trench between two traverses.
Would you put any covering over the front, or would it just be open?
No, not at first, we did not. But when gas came, we did. But that wasn't at Maricourt.
Inside the thing, how deep would it be, and approximately? So about 4 or 5 feet.
5 feet, yes.
Cut into the side.
Yes, 5 feet, and perhaps 10 feet in, 5 feet, 5 feet high, and then a matter of about enough for five men to lie down on top of one, legs on top of one another's legs.
Would you have any lighting or any sort of fittings at all inside, or is it just bare earth walls?
That's all. There's nothing there at all in the way of lighting.
Would you keep any personal possessions in there at all, or would you leave anything in there? One of these dugouts or not?
No, you were supposed to be fully equipped the whole time, except when you were allowed off duty. Then you could take your haversack off and hang that up. But it must be, of course, immediately available to be put on in case you were being raided.
And you'd hang this up inside the dugout which you were using for the
above her head. Yes, yes. That would only be the pack, but otherwise all our other equipment would be on us, and we'd have our rifle probably between our knees, unloaded.
So you never took your clothes off?
No. No.
Would the dugout have any sort of protection against artillery fire built into it? Would it have wooden beams as supports? Would it have any corrugated iron as a roof?
No, as I say, we were in trenches which the French had made, and whereas later we were in delightful trenches where we went down steps and it was dry and comfortable, there was no mud in the little dugouts as there was out in the trench. It may be that to get in them, you probably had to step a little bit above the mud to get in and lie on wet, but at least not 1 foot or 2 foot depth of mud.
So it'd be sort of damp, but not...
That's right, that's all. Sometimes we did cut a sack open and use that as a curtain to the front of the trench to stop the winter wind coming in. But there had to be quick access out of the dugout, you know, in case we were being raided.
Were these dugouts very claustrophobic when say you had five people in there? Did people get on each other's nerves inside such a confined space?
No, we were glad to be in there in the 2 hours we or less that we were in there at night time, because the terms of duty were 1 hour on the fire step, 2 hours off. But of that 2 hours off, some had to be for doing trench cleaning work.
What I'd like to ask you now about is something you've mentioned before, the rations of various kinds that
yes.
they were given to. Could we deal with your basic rations in the front line first?
Yes.
How were rations issued to you?
Well, they were issued at midnight. The company in support behind you, they would carry the rations up to you in the front line, and then they'd be distributed under the platoon sergeant's instructions. So we put them away, tin food and sticks and charcoal to light a fire. You could get a fire going. In other words, you could boil your own tea as well as that which came up in the big 20-gallon Dixies.
Oh, well, let's run through these things that were issued at 12 o'clock. You say tinned food. What sort of tinned food would
well,
it be?
Well, it was jam.
How was that? What was that sort?
Yeah, my wife and I thought it up. I can't think again now, but you didn't need to say jam. You just said the name of the firm who made it. Yes, there was tins of Tickler's jam. One had a tin each.
What did you think of the jam? What was it
well,
like?
Well, it was better than nothing. Yes, it was had a bit of taste to the bread and butter. Now, the communication trench was so bad that people who were on trench fatigue, that's to say the people in support behind us, often enough had to let the sacks of food drop into the mud. So it came up to us not as a loaf, but just crust and crumb. And I think we had...
This bread would come up at 12 o'clock as well, would it?
That's right, yes. And I think then at that stage, we were four to a loaf. Now, that was a two-pound loaf in those days, which anyhow really wasn't very much. But when it wasn't slices of bread, and if you were late getting to yours, all you had at the bottom when it came to your turn was just a bit of crust, you know, that you had. But also we had fried bacon, and it came up with the fat cold. The slices of bacon were...
That would also come up at 12 o'clock, would it?
Yes, and that then we'd have our slice of bacon issued to us by the sergeant. But I noticed that when the people came up the next time to take these empty bacon trays down, that people had only just taken the actual lean bacon. So I used to, the first opportunity, I used to go along when the thing was, when the bacon dixies were lying out there. I went along when nobody was taking any notice of them, and scraped up with my knife all the frozen fat and put it into my